Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Sanjay Torre, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And got a full house here today.
Yeah, I'm really excited to hear about all these stories.
Exactly. So let's just jump right into it. We're going to lead off with Gabe Orthos with Central Georgia Health Network. Hey, Gabe.
Good morning.
How's that drive in? Got to experience Atlanta traffic firsthand, huh?
400 is a journey.
It's a journey. So tell us about Central Georgia Health Network. How are you serving folks?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm the Chief Information Officer for Central Georgia Health Network. We're an organization that supports 1,100 providers in the Central Georgia region, which encompasses a large footprint of all the way from the perimeter down to Florida, essentially.
Wow.
So these are independent providers that are looking to transform their practices towards value-based care. These are providers that have been, practicing for a number of years and have been affiliated with Navison, which is the medical center down in Macon, Georgia. So we are proud to support them from an organization perspective. We do a lot of their contracting helping them towards the transformational changes that need to happen for our physicians in order to encompass these new payment models that are coming down from CMS and other payers in the industry.
So now, what is on the kind of roadmap? What kind of disruption can we expect moving forward?
I think that we are very similar to many other organizations concerning information, data, business intelligence. Our biggest impetus for transforming is, the high cost of healthcare. So there's a bunch of catalysts that are happening today around this data liquidity, big data, AI. All of these different kind of transforming technologies are starting to impact the healthcare space, primarily to solve the equation of higher quality, lower cost.
So now some of these organizations have been around a long time, and then it's hard to make change in
Absolutely.
These kind of large institutions. How do you help them make the change?
Yeah. So it's definitely a cultural, battle that we have to face on a daily basis. A lot of these hospital systems, not just in Georgia, but throughout the United States, have been ingrained in this whole idea of fee-for-service. So when you go to the doctor, there's specific codes that happen, and based on those codes that the doctor does on you, they'll get paid on. And then there's an adjudication process, and eventually the payer, whether that's a commercial payer like Aetna, Cigna, et cetera, Humana, or CMS for that matter for Medicare, they will pay on those specific transactions, right? Where things are changing, and with the Obamacare kind of ACA model, we started to see more around quality and understanding the quality of care and understanding the cost of care. So you start hearing things, programs coming out of CMS and HHS around accountable care organizations, ACOs. So how do you transform? How do you move the ship when we've always done it this way type of mentality? And like in any other business, that's a very dangerous phrase to say. But to me, from an information and data perspective, is when you say things like, I don't know what I don't know, because that's even more complicated, right? Because if you don't know your business and where can you transform, you don't know where you're going, you don't know where you're steering your ship.
Well, when you have the healthcare system, when at one point the A went stood for affordable, and now the A stands for accountable, those two words aren't really connected a lot of times.
They're not. I agree with that. I think that's a great point. Affordability is one thing, and is associated with cost and utilization. Accountability is based on how do we make the players in that system accountable for the patient population and the patient
and for the results, right?
And for the results.
Because at one point you got paid for effort.
Correct.
And now you're getting paid for results.
Correct. So, and the best way of really explaining that is how we define quality and quality measures. So think of NCQA, HEDIS types of measures. These are measures that have a numerator denominator that give you kind of a sense for what's happening with your populations in general. So there's performance measures that essentially say, here are the things that you were supposed to do, right? HbA1c, for example, is a hemoglobin type of lab that needs to happen for every diabetic. If you don't do that lab, right, you're not going to meet that measure. So that's performance-based. In other words, the payers are saying, you're supposed to do these things, you just haven't done them, mm-hmm. right? And then on the other side, there's a performance measure kind of thing. And the performance measure starts to really quantify, is the patient actually getting better? And that's more longitudinal, right? Because how do we define quality for a specific patient is really, do they actually get better?
But it's difficult because the patient has a lot of power in this. Because if the patient doesn't take their medicine or they aren't complying with the, you know, the lifestyle changes that are needed, then they're not going to get better, no matter what the doctor does or what the healthcare system provides.
Absolutely. Right on. I call that the inside the walls of my organizations, right? Patient presents, they open the door, they come into, and I know everything about that patient for about 15, 20 minutes that they're in front of me. But there's a lot more going on outside the walls of my organization. And I think that organizations like myself or clinical integrated networks are starting to realize that there's a much bigger footprint of where that care is being done and the modalities that are being done. And so I'll give you an example. My dad is a diabetic. He goes to CVS every day. So CVS sees my dad almost on a daily
more
basis.
Than two.
more than the primary care, more than the care manager,
right.
more than the hospitalist, et cetera. So there are modalities of care that these patients are going to, and there are data being generated out of each one of these settings.
But then how do you how does the healthcare provider kind of have accountability if ultimately if the patient isn't compliant, how can the healthcare provider possibly be accountable?
Absolutely. I think it's a hard prop, and I think that CMS is starting to change that modality of giving 100% of that risk to the provider and saying, if you don't do these things, you will not get paid, right? Because that's a risk associated with that. I can't enact change on a payer, on a patient that's not going to comply, like you're saying, right? But I think things are changing from trying to, instead of giving the provider-patient relationship that one-to-one relationship, we're starting to see more of an end-to-one, right? So it's a network of providers, it's a network of modalities that are trying to enact change of that patient. At the end of the day, it's the patient's health and it's the patient's whether they want to follow the certain rules of what we're putting in front of them. But the compliance, right, is starting to change with a program called Primary Care First. It just got introduced at HIMSS this year, at the beginning of the year, with CMS. This is a program that on 2020, we're starting to see new payment models and new kind of affiliated networks of truth as opposed to a single source of truth.
Mm-hmm. So now for your network, how do you go about kind of serving this constituency because it's so large of a footprint, like you said?
Yeah. So we try not to boil the ocean, and I know that that's kind of a cliche of especially around data and analytics, but we try to optimize and have continual improvement on the low-hanging fruit of things that we know how to do, right? So, for example, annual wellness visits for Medicare, it's a proven touch point for patients. And so if we can increase that and not just get to the 80% and call it a day because that's what CMS wants us to do, but how do we get that 20 extra percent, right? And how do we finish? Because those are things that are very well documented. So we understand. Same thing with care gaps or same things with closing care gaps, specifically around those process kind of quality measures. Those are things that could be done today and we can improve year over year over those things. Eventually, we want to get to a much broader kind of population view, what I call the critical path, right? So that we are able to predict when a patient presents to the ED, any ED for that matter, not necessarily our hospital, but any hospital in the state, that we can put them through a critical path of lower cost, higher quality, right? What are the things that we can navigate that patient through so that we can guarantee a certain level of service for that patient.
Now, does that require all of kind of the healthcare providers to get on the same page and work together?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it is a transformational change that has to happen. So there's a lot of change management that is occurring right now in our industry. We have providers, and I call it kind of like a bell curve of these things, right? So the early adopters get it, right? The things are changing, payment models are changing. We have to change the way that we do healthcare in this country. On the other end, you may have providers that are like, fee-for-service is never going away. I will always get paid. We're on a fee schedule, you know, et cetera. So, and somewhere in the middle, you'll have the majority of the providers kind of figuring out what's going on. So it is a change management.
What about in the kind of places that don't have the money to invest in this kind of massive change? Like, how do you accommodate them?
Yeah, I mean, it is a foundational investment that has to happen around technology.
But
data,
in some of the rural areas that don't maybe have as many resources, how do they get to participate?
Right, and our network is rural as well. So I think that in coming together into a network-based system where we can help each other, where you have a support mechanism from the network level that allows you to do small changes, transformational changes at the practice level, we're starting to see more and more regional organizations coming together in groups, many different types of organizations. There's IPAs, which is independent providers coming together. Then they may become a PHO, which they are actually aligned with a hospital. They may become a CIN, clinical integration systems. So you're starting to see these organizations throughout the United States coming together. The individual provider by themselves in the middle of nowhere type of thing is becoming more of a rarity to see. We're starting to see also a lot of hospital systems coming in. Case in point, Atrium Healthcare, Carolina Health System, came and bought Navison, right? So now you have the Carolinas, South Carolina, North Carolina coming into the Georgia market. Right, we saw the same thing, the same idea of the Kaiser model in California, Philadelphia, New York. We've seen these kind of big system kind of collaborating, coming together.
And then, what about like things like telemedicine, where you can kind of virtually have a physician in some of these areas that maybe are underserved? Are you seeing more and more of that?
I think so. And I'm starting to see payment models that enable a provider to really get paid for those services, mm-hmm. and understanding, if they're not going to be able to touch the patient, what are the things that they can do? There's a lot of stuff that from a patient-provider relationship cannot be done through telemedicine. So I think we're starting to carve out the things that make sense. I'm a Generation Xer. I use my telemedicine doctor. I don't necessarily need to have a relationship with that doctor,
right.
As long as he's available when he says he's going to be available, and he can, have a phone in front of him and kind of see me and have a conversation. I don't mind paying out of pocket for that, right? I don't mind paying a copay for that. I think it's generational also. You're starting to see a lot of the generation starting to do a lot more telemedicine. The things that really engage me or really have a big future for me is around mental and behavioral health, because that's something that we have a problem not only here in Georgia but throughout the United States on access. So more to come. I think that the payment model is going to drive that usability.
So now what do you need more of right now? How can we help?
I need more time. I need more time. I think that all of these models are changing very rapidly. We are I call it kind of the schizophrenic reality of healthcare, where every month something else bubbles up to the top. So we try to focus on things that are important to us, things that are important to our network, to our providers, and how do we elevate them, right, so that they can practice medicine, which is what we need them to do, but at the same time be sustainable from a business perspective. And we forget that sometimes, right? All of these models are great, and we try to create a portfolio management of having different types of populations, whether it's Medicare, whether it's commercial, whether it's kids, et cetera. But really, right now, we're getting put in so many different situations and so many different things that it's hard to concentrate and focus on one population and getting them better, because everybody is important.
Right.
So it is a, all over the place type of thing.
So now, is there anything from, are you seeing any decline in talent, or are people choosing not to get involved in healthcare and being a doctor because of the complexity and all of the unknowns?
Yeah. So I am, shameless plug here, I am going to start teaching a population health management course at Georgia State University. Have been teaching at Sacred Heart University out of Connecticut, population health management. The master's program In Connecticut is more of a informatics type of thing. Here in Georgia is more of a public health. So we're starting to see the transformation of our students thinking about value-based care, which to me is very important for them to understand the business of healthcare, not just the epidemiology kind of academic exercise of understanding populations, kind of the CDC way of looking at the world, right? I want them to look at it from the perspective of a payer, from a perspective of a technologist, from a perspective of a provider, from a perspective of a hospitalist, right? So having that totality of what you need. I'm starting to see changes in curriculum here in Georgia especially. I've worked with Emory, and I've worked now with Georgia State, and I think it's important to teach our students that are coming out, whether they're going into the clinical space or they're going into the administration space, right, that they understand that it's not just anymore inside the walls of a hospital.
Now, but are you seeing a decline in the number? Are people saying, you know what, I thought I wanted to be a doctor, but it just seems like more trouble than it's worth. I got to invest all this time. There's all this change. I don't know what, you know, coming up down the road, how it's going to pay off. Mm-hmm. I have all this student debt.
Yeah, absolutely. From a clinical perspective here in Georgia, I think we've steadied our influx of MDs that are going in through those programs. More importantly for me, I'm starting to see more and more people getting to maybe be in a LPN or
physician
RN,
assistant.
Physician assistant.
So that exactly. There's more people kind of at that level. And that's those are a lot of times the boots on the ground that you need those people.
Correct. So from a team-based, support-based environment of these clinicians, not just the white lab coat, right? MD or DO or whatever it may be. Now we're starting to see the support mechanism underneath them. And my network tries to provide support for them as well, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we create pre-visit planning so that they have the data, so that they have the things that they need to do for a specific patient beforehand, right? So when the provider sees the patient, they can just do 1, 2, 3 things as opposed to doing 150 tasks that need to happen.
So now for you, who is your client? Is your client these hospitals? Are they the individual doctor? Who do you serve specifically?
I serve the providers. I serve the providers in the network. I elevate them every day. I try to elevate them every day from a data and technology perspective. We have clinical liaisons that go out to the practices and help them really kind of move the needle towards this transformational impact that has to happen from a workflow perspective. So it's not just a matter of giving them a report and saying, here's 150 patients that you haven't met your A1C for, but how do we help you, provider, in your workflow, in your EMR, to make sure that we are doing the things that you're supposed to, so that you can get credit, right? Mm-hmm. Not only get credit, but also get paid for those value-based incentives.
So then the outcome after working with you is that they make more money and are kind of not handling some of these administrative type headaches that are bogging down their practice?
Yes, that's correct.
And then if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
MyCGHN.com is our webpage. Follow us on Facebook as well as LinkedIn.
And then you're here in Central Georgia primarily right now. Do you see this going around the country, or is this, you have enough to keep you busy here in Georgia?
I think our organization is very similar to other organizations in the state and throughout the country. We are becoming a much larger network because of Atrium Healthcare coming from the Carolinas. I think that our intent is to support our providers and become a bigger network if that's what, you know, what the board decides to do. From my perspective, you know, I'm just putting my head down and trying to support the ones that
all
I have
done,
right now.
Right? Exactly. That's enough to keep you busy. All right. One more time, the website.
MyCGHN.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you.
All right. Hang with us. A couple more guests. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have Michael Starling and Katie Williams. Michael is the Director of Economic Development with Dunwoody, and Katie is the Executive Director of Discover Dunwoody. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
So which one of you is the ringleader of this crew?
I'm not sure. I think we're equals.
All right, equals. Who's going to equally begin this?
Michael
will begin. Very good. So tell us about what's going on in Dunwoody, Michael.
Katie and I have worked together for quite a number of years, but recently we've started working much more closely because we realized that at the city, economic development and what Katie does at the Convention and Visitors Bureau is really linked. Mm-hmm. We're doing the same thing. It's really about destination marketing, development, and management. And so a few months ago, we decided, hey, why don't we really work together, more of a partnership. And so we're out now talking to people about not just growing the job market, recruiting new businesses, but also talking to visitors and people living in Dunwoody. So we're really selling Dunwoody in a new way.
So now I see that you're calling it perimeter Dunwoody market.
Yes.
How are you defining that? There's such an overlap now.
Yes.
With Sandy Springs, Brookhaven, Chamblee, you got everybody's kind of in the mix here.
Yeah, the market can be really hard to define for residents and especially for visitors or businesses looking to move into the area. For us, we look at Dunwoody as a whole, and then we look specifically at the perimeter Dunwoody market, which is our side of perimeter. Central perimeter is multi-jurisdictional with Brookhaven, Sandy Springs, and Dunwoody. But when you think about the Ashford-Dunwoody corridor, Perimeter Mall, Perimeter Center West, Abernathy, which is really the heart of perimeter, that's the Dunwoody perimeter market.
So your Dunwoody is like from Perimeter Mall to Dunwoody Village. Is that the center? Is that how you see it? Or
I think from a business standpoint, it is. When you think about where the businesses are headquartered and located, and so much of the economic development activity from that standpoint. But of course, Dunwoody encompasses more than that with the Dunwoody Village and Georgetown and further over to Brook Run Park. And that's the benefit of Dunwoody and the Dunwoody Perimeter Market, right, is that you have this great blend of urban and suburban amenities right here, right within just a few square miles.
Now, you mentioned that there's jurisdictions that are overlapping. Is that one of the challenges, is to differentiate yourself but still be part of the whole kind of group?
So.
Yeah. It always has been. And it's not that we want to be separate from Perimeter. I mean, Perimeter is the largest office and retail market in the region, but our market is developing a little differently, and we're making investments to help make that happen. And so we do want to differentiate a little bit, so not just people outside, but also people inside understand that that part of Perimeter Market is going to develop a little differently. We're focused on walkability, building parks and green space, really trying to make a real place instead of a suburban, car-oriented market. We're trying to move to more walkable.
So now, that being said, what's your perfect vision of Dunwoody? How do you see it in your dream world?
Oh, wow.
And I think if you ask 10 different people, you're going to get 10 different
answers.
I know,
but I got you two here. Yeah.
So I think the walkability is
so walkability.
Huge. Walkability is so important. And when we think about the spaces that we're all looking for today, where we want to spend our time, where we want to live, we want a place that's going to allow us to walk and have experiences, whether it's going from restaurants and dining and evening experiences to being able to be close to work, close to how we spend our free time. So I think that walkability is so important, and the green space as well, especially for families who are looking for the area. Families, but all people who may be looking for the area. I mean, I think green space, parks, trails, all of that is really important.
So now, is there a city you're modeling this after, or a market that you're kind of in your head, you're visualizing that you'd like Dunwoody to emulate or look like?
I don't think so. There are obviously a lot of great places around. I think one of the things that we're seeing is obviously we have competitors. We compete with Midtown, Alpharetta, Cumberland, and what we're seeing is they're developing places, destinations that draw people not just during the day but at night and on the weekends for concerts and outdoor activities. So we're looking at the Battery and at Avalon and places like that to get ideas, and that's where the market is moving anyway. That's where people, what we're seeing, people want workers as well as residents. So we're really not modeling on one particular place.
But there's a different feel. Like if you go to the Decatur Square, has a certain kind of look and feel and an ambiance.
Yep.
And then you go to Avalon, and that, you know, a lot of people go to both those places, but it's a different kind of vibe in each one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very different. But you look at the things that the commonalities, and again, it goes back to walkability and experiences. And I think that's what we're trying to draw upon. But we certainly don't want to discount what we have to offer as a base. I mean, we have an unbelievable product to offer, whether it's businesses or visitors, because we are Central Perimeter, and we are at truly the epicenter of the Metro Atlanta market when it comes to not only our location, but what we have to offer businesses, the pull from the work base, the world-class retail and restaurant offerings. We have so much already, And so we just want to kind of build upon that with the way and be very intentional about the way that the market gets developed in the future.
So what's the kind of the sales pitch you're giving to restaurants or to businesses to say, you know what, you should choose Dunwoody?
Number one is connectivity and our location.
Connectivity meaning the MARTA having access to the mass
roads,
transit?
Roads 285 and 400. I mean, that really is the crossroads of the transportation network. Obviously, we have MARTA, which is a game changer. It's why State Farm and IHG and other companies have moved here. But as Atlanta has grown, it's not grown sort of from the center out. It's grown mostly northward. About 70% of all the population.
Right, the center of gravity has kind
gravity
of drifted.
Has shifted, and it's about
up 400, right?
Basically at 400 and 285. Mm-hmm. And that's the draw. It's why we call it central perimeter, because it is central. So a company like State Farm can recruit from Cobb, North Fulton, Gwinnett, as well as the in-town market, especially that we have MARTA. You get those young millennials who live in Midtown. They can be at the Dunwoody station in 10, 15 minutes.
Now, are you seeing that, in this transitional period where there's all this construction happening in this, does that make your job harder in terms of getting people to say, okay, you're going to have to stick with this for a couple of years because we're kind of growing and this is part of the growing pains of this? I mean, that's a reality of it. I mean, you can just look out the window here and see there's cranes and there's...
Yeah, there has definitely been a pause. I think it's because we've grown. State Farm, is moving 8,000 people here, so that has sort of stalled a lot of new growth. But certainly the transportation improvements, people are sort of waiting to see how that looks and how it's done. The good news is we do have, at least in the short term, a finish point, probably in late 20 or 2021, where the 400-285 interchange will be done and people will see the benefit. But I do think it has put a pause on some of the new growth.
And then if that being said, then how do you kind of serve the existing people to let them know that, hey, we're going to get through this, just bear with us for a period of time?
I think it's about communication, which we all work really hard to make sure we're putting out messages about traffic improvements and what's coming down the pipeline. Not only our two organizations, but also PCID, the Perimeter Community Improvement District, does a great job of communicating those messages from GDOT. But then also it's sending the message that enjoy what's right here, that you don't have to necessarily get in your car. If you're staying in a hotel and there's traffic happening on 285, 400 that weekend, you can walk across the street and enjoy what's right mm-hmm. there. And workers in the office market can maybe extend their hours in the market, go and have dinner or drinks after work rather than just hopping in their car and sitting in traffic. So it's sending the message that, there is traffic happening all over Atlanta and there are improvements being made, but there's a lot to do in the area as well to extend your time and kind of enjoy being where you are right now.
Now we just finished, I think it's over now, is the Dunwoody Restaurant Week, or we're at the tail end of it?
We just finished it on Saturday. Yes.
So now things like that where you're creating events kind of out of thin air, that's part of what you're trying to do too, be creative and create as much engagement with the people that are part of the community.
Right. Yeah. It's about creating destination appeal and giving people a reason to experience what Dunwoody has to offer. And Dunwoody Restaurant Week, this was the 8th year and it was a huge success this year. A lot of the restaurants said that they had more covers than ever before. And so again, it's about telling people what's here and how they can experience it, whether it's Dunwoody Restaurant Week or one of the number of festivals and events that our community organizations offer. We do Arts and Culture Month in the fall. So we try to offer things and market and promote kind of what's happening in the community to let people know that how they can experience Dunwoody.
Now, are you seeing an influx of the families moving into, because a lot of this is single family homes, right? There are less apartments and condos and things like that, or is that a growing area as well?
No, we're about 50-50. So mm-hmm. Dunwoody's half your what you typically think of Dunwoody, the large lot, single family subdivisions with swim tennis, and we've seen that growing. I live in Brookhaven. I know a lot of people who live in Dunwoody, and housing market is very hot in Dunwoody. But we also have 50% of our housing stock is apartments. We're seeing a large increase in townhomes and condos. So I think one of the things that we offer as well as our location is that you can, half mile from the Dunwoody MARTA station, live in a single family, large lot, half acre house. Or you can live in an apartment or a high rise condo or townhome. So we're sort of becoming this hybrid urban suburban we're not Midtown or Buckhead, but we also aren't the perimeter mall of 20 years ago. It's becoming a much more authentic place. So the housing market is booming on all fronts, mostly, I think, because good schools, but also the access to jobs.
Now, you mentioned earlier that previously you would work kind of siloed, economic development was kind of doing their thing and the Convention Bureau was doing their thing. Now, can you share an example of how together you've kind of worked with maybe somebody who was considering moving here, maybe a corporation that was thinking about relocating?
Yeah, well, I think from our organization, historically, Convention and Visitors Bureaus are purely destination marketing, and that's certainly the core of what we do. Our job is to market and promote Dunwoody to attract visitors and meetings and groups and things like that. But more recently, you're seeing organizations like ours become destination managers and working with the city in economic development to really help create a vision and accomplish that vision for what the destination can become. And that's where it's so important that our organization and our board of directors works with Michael's office and the city to help kind of lead the way and all of us lead the way and pave the way for what the destination is going to become. Ultimately, we're all after the same vision. We want to make Grant Dunwoody a great place, whether it's to live, work, or play. And so by working together and sharing resources and sharing just different assets, I think we're all stronger together.
But what's an example of how, like if a company said, you know what, we're considering Dunwoody, we're considering Midtown, you know, how would you two together kind of speak to them?
I think we'd still probably do that one-off in economic development. I'm not sure the CVB would come on a sales call or work with the state when we're selling. I think it is more that we create the place, and because that's what we're selling, right? I mean, when I sit down and talk to a company that's looking to move here, they're looking at where's my workforce going to come from? Where are my people going to live? Do we have hotels and restaurants for the workers that they're going to enjoy while they're there? So it's all about that employee recruitment. There is a company that just decided to build a new headquarters in Dunwoody. It's Insight Global. And part of their development, the office had to have a hotel component with it. So the developer is actually building a new 340,000 square foot office building across the street from the new State Farm headquarters. And right behind that, connected to the office building, is a hotel. It's a 10-story Hyatt Place. Mm-hmm. And so that's one way that maybe the two organizations didn't pitch that together, but it shows the importance of the amenity base and the destination and the hotels of companies want those things close by and connected.
Now, is there any type of industry you'd like to see more of come to Dunwoody? Is there kind of a hole that you would like to fill?
Well, the city loves hotels. That's one of the reasons we work closely together.
So you would like more hotels?
Oh, yeah. We would
that's
love
a careful statement.
Yeah, I'm not sure if the hotels want
more hotels.
from a economic standpoint, they're the best land use that we can
Why
have.
Is that?
Well, first, the people who come and stay there leave, and so we're not providing services for them. They don't go to schools. You know, they don't go to the parks necessarily. But it's also the business license and the hotel motel tax, which is very important to local governments, is a revenue source. It's all positive. They go to the restaurants, they go shopping. It's all positive economically. From a business standpoint, probably more technology. We have always been a sort of a headquarter, either regional or national headquarter. All of Perimeter has been that, and we're really focusing much more on technology companies.
Now, is there a niche within technology, like in Alpharetta? There's a lot of healthcare IT kind of technology up there.
We don't really have a specific focus. We're looking at all those things. Payment is really big in Perimeter, and we're certainly seeing a growth in that. But really, any technology that's looking at anyone who needs the workforce from North Fulton as well as the workforce in Midtown. We offer that midpoint for those companies.
What about, is there any kind of incubator, accelerator, co-working
there are a number of co-working
that you're doing,
facilities
but as a government to kind of invest in that?
We've not invested in that. We think that with what Georgia Tech has done and what the private companies are now doing with co-working, that's sort of better left for those
But like somebody like David Cumming does Tech Village.
Tech Village. Mm-hmm. So we'd love for him to do something like that here. That was a private sector decision.
But is there something that you can attract a local Dunwoody in to say, hey,
we've talked to a lot of people. They haven't had the same vision as David, mm-hmm. and that has been a hugely successful vision, and we hope to see more of that. We've talked to a number of people, but nothing is sort of on the ground.
Now, is there any, you mentioned there's private companies doing co-working and I know technology here in the area. What would be an example of a way that you could kind of partner with somebody that has something in order to do something that attracts these up-and-coming technology companies that some of which might become the next David Cumming?
We've got a lot of office space. Right now we have about 1 million square feet of office just in Dunwoody. State Farm finished their first building last year, and so that has left a pretty significant void, which is good and bad. One of the good things is that there's now a lot of office space
that's
on the
open now they build their buildings.
Yeah, right. And that will continue to happen over the next 2 or 3 years as they finish construction. So that's going to offer, I think, sort of maybe a public-private partnership opportunity mm-hmm. for some of that space. Actually, one of the smaller offices in Dunwoody, Serendipity Labs, which is a new co-working, mm-hmm. they've got 2 or 3 locations. They're opening their latest in Dunwoody. And so they, as an old SunTrust mortgage office that they moved out of, and Serendipity Labs took 2.5 floors there, I think there's a lot more opportunity for that kind of thing, specifically focused on the technology field.
So now, for people who aren't familiar with Dunwoody, what is like kind of a go-to thing that you would recommend them checking out so they get a feel for it?
That's a great question, and there's so many places. Of course, I mean, we have a number of restaurants. Just depends on the time of day and what you're looking for. Del Frisco's Double Eagle Steakhouse just opened up at the new State Farm building, and mm-hmm. that is a beautiful restaurant and offers a really unique dining experience. McKendrick Steakhouse, of course, is a long-time Dunwoody mm-hmm. go-to. Vino Venue is a unique wine concept that has Enomatic wine machines. It's always a lot of fun. But then there's so many hidden gems throughout our community as well. The Dunwoody Nature Center, just 2 or 2.5 miles outside of Central Perimeter, will put you in a space that you think you're miles outside the city, with a hammock garden and a hidden playground and nature trails. It's just really beautiful. And a number of family dining restaurants as well. So I think there's something for everybody. Just depends on what you're looking for. And then, of course, we have Perimeter Mall, which is the Southeast's second largest shopping mall and continues to thrive and offer new new stores and retailing offers. And they've got some new restaurants coming in there. So that mall is thriving beyond all expectations.
And Michael, for you, when you're pitching somebody to come maybe out of state to Dunwoody, where do you take them?
McKendrick's a lot. We spend a lot of time there. Doug McKendrick has sort of started the steakhouse in Perimeter back in the early 90s. That's a good one. Novo Cucina is in the Village, which is a really unique sort of neighborhood Italian restaurant. Those are two good too.
So not, what is it, Dave's Killer Cheesesteaks? You don't take people there?
No, that's really good. I'm not sure. I've never taken a recruitment prospect.
Yeah, I think you should. Especially if they're from Philadelphia.
Really good, yeah. They would love it. Yeah, we're driving into the parking lot. Yeah. Like, get some
look, that's part of the feel, right?
Yes.
It's authentic.
So, it is authentic.
If somebody went to learn more about what's going on in Dunwoody, where would you send them?
Well, we'd certainly encourage them to go to discoverdunwoody.com, which is where you're going to find a wealth of information happening, events, things to do, places to go. And then the City of Dunwoody's website would offer a lot of information as well.
Yeah, and that's dunwoodyga.gov.
And then is there a farmer's market? Do you have
we do.
Farmers,
we do.
Markets?
Farmer's market.
Where does that take place?
That's Saturday mornings at Brook Run Park.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Just started up for the season, I think, mm-hmm. 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Good stuff. Well, thank you both for sharing your story.
Thank you.
All right. Hang with us. One more guest. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we've got an old friend, and I think he brought a new friend with us. We got Seven Chan and Mitch Jaffe. Is that correct?
Jaffe.
And Seven is with a variety of sushi and poke restaurants. So what are you up to today, Seven?
Hey, well, first, thank you guys for having me back. It's been a little while, but this is kind of like my home radio station.
Exactly.
For the city, so.
That's the way we look at it.
Yeah, but no, I'm up to many, many things. We have many more Pokeburi and Lifting Noodle Ramens coming kind of in Atlanta and all over the country. I think we're on our way to 20-something right now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I always tell people, congratulate me when they're all open and we're successful. But we'll see. We have our fingers crossed. And then today, we're kind of here to talk about our kind of newest project, and we have Mitch here with us, and it's going to be at the Battery, and it is Feast. So, Mitch, say hi and say some stuff.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Sure. Well, tell us about Feast. What's your vision? And it's spelled in a funky way, so I know it's something cool that's happening over there.
P-H apostrophe E-A-S-T.
So there's East in there. There's a P-H, maybe for pho. I don't know. What is the angle for this?
It's a play on words. It's a play on eating, food, and the tagline is a Far East Street Feast.
All right.
What we tried to generally do here was to bring an authentic...
You got to stay in front of the mic like yes. a rock star.
What Feast is accomplishing here is bringing authentic Asian cuisine in sort of a hawker style stall environment to the Battery. There's really no Asian offering right now in the Battery, and we're bringing best in class poke and sushi, best in class ramen and Laotian food, and we're negotiating the last stall to either be Korean or Vietnamese, most likely. We also have a best-in-class tea operator, and we brought in the operators from Truck and Tap, who are kind of an acclaimed suburban bar that brings in the beer selection, cocktails, and wine. So if you put it all in there, it's a 5,000-square-foot offering in the Battery, and it's missing... piece in that 60-acre development outside of the Braves Stadium.
So now you walk in, and it's kind of its own little food court kind of setup. Where are they all sharing a kitchen? Is that how this works, or how does the kind of logistics of it work?
So I hate the word food court because it generally, if you close your eyes, you think about your mall food
right.
court. It's very sterile. This is going to be an experiential place for sure. You're going to come in. It's going to feel like one establishment, but with each operator being independent, they cook at their own stall. You could say it's a little bit like Krog Street Market or Pond City Market from that perspective.
What about like Canteen on the where the General Muir folks have? Is it something like that where there's multiple kind of concepts, but they're all under one, I guess, umbrella?
Yeah, these are all independent operators.
Right.
Seven is operating both Pokeburi and Lifting Noodles, and we have a Snack Box Bistro, which is the chef won Best Chef in Atlanta by Eater last year, and she's operating Laotian street food. And, of course, Truck and Tap's doing their thing, and a operator called Kung Fu Tea that's already on Buford Highway is going to be doing multiple kinds.
So you're trying to make Buford Highway appear in the Battery?
That's
a mini Buford Highway?
Actually, if we accomplish that, I feel like we've done something. I am a huge fan of what goes on Buford Highway.
Yeah, me too. So now, so this was your vision?
I'd like to take full credit for it, but we can't.
You're the only one here.
No.
Who else is going to take credit?
There's a gentleman named David Smith who came to me. I've known David 12 years. He brought me the concept, and we started trying to make it into a reality. And
what was the hardest part? The math of making it work, or getting the people to kind of believe that they can all work together in this kind of environment that's different than their typical restaurant?
Well, it's not cheap space at the Battery, so the math had to work. The design, my architect is Jason Moss with Jones Pierce. We've been working together about 25 years on development. And per square foot, he confirmed to me that this is the most intense per square foot design we've had to do. You know, the HVAC system and all that is just intense.
So now, when you're working with kind of all these independent restaurateurs that tend to be kind of picky, you know, restaurateurs, they have visions and
we're very picky.
Yes,
right. Absolutely.
And then you're saying, hey, you're going to all be kind of next to each other, but it's not a food court. So take that out of play, no matter if you might think it is just from the outside. How did you kind of handle all these egos and these opinions? How did you manage that?
So I rely heavily on Seven.
I'd say we're still figuring out that part. I mean, I guess the biggest part is we're all committed to providing a real experience that you really can't find anywhere else. So imagine you're in New York and you dip onto a side street and you see all these amazing little things that nobody knows, or in the middle of Japan. And imagine you can kind of come in here and to compare it to Canteen, kind of like you're saying, the experience is different of it. And I think it is more experiential, and it is more of an like a whole thing. Like, you can go and this will catch your eye. This smell will have your head turning this way. And it's really kind of like Mitch said, and not to kind of like talk and brag, but like, it is really, I want to say, best in class concepts of what we have here. So you may find something, you may find Snack Box in another part of Atlanta, but you're not going to find the same experience. You're not going to see the same food offering, same as for Poke Burry and Lifting Noodles. And we're excited by the energy that the place brings, you know, to itself, being in the Battery and being in Smyrna and really just being the
first. But it's a destination within a destination.
It is. I mean, we think it's a great destination aside from just the baseball, aside from just the concerts. You know, it's a great market, and there's a lot of people there. And, you know, being in the restaurant business, we hear people that are like, when are you coming to our area? When are you coming here? When are you coming here? And now we are.
So now you're trying to create this as a, like I said, a destination within a destination. So people are going to come just for this. And this is like, how would I come with a group of people? What would be your dream way of us kind of managing coming to Feast? Is it we all go to different places within there? What would be the best outcome?
I'll give my personal experience. My sister lives in Singapore, and I went to visit her a couple years ago, and I went to the True Authentic Hawker Markets. We all hit different booths and sat in common seating areas and enjoyed what we were able to gather. You know, for those 15 minutes, we left each other, came back, and we all shared the food. I think that experience at Feast would be awesome because you get to taste a lot of different things. Yeah, so, it'd be a great place to come and share food with others.
Uh-huh.
And then you go over to the bar and you can have, you know, one of 40 taps of cocktails, beers, and wine also.
So now you said that it's all full, or you have one slot left. What's going on there?
We have one slot left, and we're keying in on either Vietnamese or Korean as the operator.
And then so now when you're are you recruiting? So like, you put the word out and go, okay, how does this work?
We're letting people fight to the death for fight the last to the spot. Death. So, yeah.
What is it, sumo? How are they? What's the fighting style?
Sharp sticks.
Sharp sticks. Chopsticks?
It's a mix.
Chopsticks. There you go.
Yeah, it's a mix of kind of finding who is complementary to all of us as a team, and kind of what we feel like the market wants. So we have a lot of exciting people, but it's a secret right now, so we can't announce it. Next time we're back, we'll let everyone know.
And then when is this? Is the space open, or it's you're waiting for that last person to come on board, and then you're open?
We're under construction, and we're targeting September 1st as the opening.
Okay, so then when it opens, the great fanfare. All the shops will be open. The person, you know, I went to the Battery, I go in there, and I'm going to just hang out there. I can hang out there for hours, right? Because there's drinking, there's food, and it's kind of nibbling food. It doesn't have to be like big meal food, right?
Right. You hit on the difference between this and a food court. Food court, you generally go in, you grab what you want to eat, you
sit
down.
And then pass out in the corner because it's all this bad food.
We don't want that either. So you come in, you hit it on the head. It's experiential. We're actually building an elevated DJ booth in there. So as the space transitions to the evening and the night, or after a ball game, we're going to pump up the volume a little bit.
And then what is Prep at ATL? What is that? Is this related to this, or that separate?
That's my company. I started with partners Doug Moranci, J.R. Santos, and Michelle Jaffe. We started Prep 5 years ago. We opened. We're now the largest food incubator in the country. accelerator. I like to use the word accelerator. We've helped 400 companies launch their food businesses here in Atlanta. And
so where is Prep and what happens in there?
Prep is located right at Chamblee Tucker and 85, just inside the perimeter. And it's we're finishing up our third phase. We'll be 83,000 square feet of commercial kitchens. Right now there's 160 operators. Once the new building is finished, we'll house 200 food companies from various...
Like food trucks to restaurants to people with an idea?
Yeah, we're also the largest food truck commissary in the South. So we have 50 food trucks based out of Prep, catering companies, CPG companies, meal prep companies, meal kit companies, central commissaries for restaurants. IHG, who's in Dunwoody, their test kitchen is at Prep for their Americas. So they develop their food for their hotels there.
Was this a build it and they will come kind of venture? How did you kind of make this happen? Because this seems amazing.
Dropped as a baby, probably. demand. A lot of – there wasn't anyone really paying attention to the needs of all these smaller – food entrepreneurs. It's really, really a very tough go for a lot of food entrepreneurs to not only secure a facility, but the amount of money they might have to put into someone else's space to activate it for their need. And then what happens if they grow? There's a fear if you grow your business, you might outgrow your space, and then you've signed a five-year lease. What Prep does is it's a membership-based facility, so we accelerate your business, whether it's a startup or it's already been in business, or even you're a regional or national company. We have a few of those. You'll come to us and we're malleable on what your facility needs and what your service needs are.
What's it smell like there?
It's pretty awesome most days. You walk through the facility and there's
all types of food from all over the planet.
You walk past our coffee roaster and you smell that, or you walk past somebody making kombucha and you smell that, and then you have people making meals every day. A lot of catering, a lot of meal prep.
Are you seeing more of these? I'm seeing them in like grocery stores where they're like meal kits. Do you guys do any of that?
So we do have a company called Garnish and Gather based out of our facility, and they're a very local. This is an example of a meal kit company. They're not like Blue Apron. What they do is they curate local ingredients and put a local restaurant recipe with it and mail it out to you. That's a meal kit where you cook it yourself. We have a ton of prepared meal companies. Well, let's say you're following a paleo diet and you know you don't have the time to cook all those healthy meals. Well, this company, we have like five of those companies that will just prepare them and deliver them to your house.
Now, are you seeing a trend of kind of virtual restaurants where they don't really have customers come in? Maybe they have takeout, but they don't have the traditional seating and the employees that you would have, and it's just meant for the delivery services?
Yeah, we are seeing a bit of that. Ghost restaurant, virtual restaurant, dark restaurant, they're all sort of the same concept where it online on Grubhub, Uber Eats, or DoorDash.
It looks like a restaurant when you're with your phone skimming through the thing, right?
That's correct. Seven and I became fast friends, and I'm actually a partner in Truck and Tap in Alpharetta, and we have a kitchen there, and we thought it would be great to be activated as a ghost kitchen because in the Alpharetta zip code, there wasn't anyone really doing an awesome job with sushi and pokey, and I know how awesome Seven's operation is, and we made a deal for him to take over our kitchen, not only serve the customers at Truck and Tap during certain hours when the food truck's not activated, but to make it a ghost kitchen or virtual kitchen. And he's been at it a month, if you want to speak to him.
Yeah, so, I mean, we opened in Alpharetta about a month ago, and it's been really cool to see the reception and people be excited about us. And it's another one of those people have been telling me forever, like, you got to come to Alpharetta. And
right.
Now we're here, so definitely come check us out. We are at the Truck and Tap for lunch every day, and then we have delivery and pickup and late night as well.
So now, Poke Berry was the kind of the genesis for a lot of this? Or
at least for me, I mean, considering that maybe 2-3 years ago, around the first time that we came to the show, we had one restaurant, and now we have 20-something. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So now, in your dream of dreams, is this how you saw it playing out?
No, not at all. You can never really plan for what happens or how fast things grow. But I think when you have, you know, really good product and a really good following, you know, things do happen very quickly. So whether it's, Pokeburi or Lifting Noodles or Feast, you know, I think a big part of our strategy is just be the best, be so dominatingly good that you don't have to worry about the other people. And then that's our goal at everything we do.
Now, Mitch, for you, when you're this philosophy, it sounds good. And everybody aspires to that. How do you kind of curate what's going on? Is it your taste buds? Who decides what's good?
No, it's supply and demand. If there's a food operator, I mean, there's stuff produced at Prep that, for example, that you know, I wasn't thinking about. But if there's a demand and there's no place to produce it and no services, mentorship, capital, marketing services around it, and if those are the missing components and we can provide them, then there's a company that's going to take off.
Now, how do you kind of create that community of collaboration in a world that's kind of a zero-sum game? You know, if I'm eating at Pokeburi, I'm not eating somewhere else.
I would say, well, speaking at Prep, I can speak to Feast. At Prep, it's very much a community. One of the reasons people do come to Prep is you get a lot of collaboration, a lot of knowledge from your fellow food service companies, and that's invaluable. If you're at the end of a industrial road by yourself, great, you're producing, but you're not having that interaction with the community, and you don't have the resources to share with each other. So as a group, we become very important. 160 companies, like, for example, the food procurement is all aggregated through our partnership with a company called Gordon Foods. So we get big buying power for our members.
So the small guy gets big buying power of a big guy.
That's it. Yep. 5-day a week delivery, you know, no minimums. They can't get that on their own.
If they were on their own, that would never happen.
Right. So people pay attention to Prep's businesses as a whole, and it just accelerates those companies.
What's the kind of, if you were giving advice to a young entrepreneur, food entrepreneur, what is a mistake you see them make?
You can't be a hobbyist. You know, a lot of people will say, you know, hey, you'll make something at a party, and all your friends say, that's the best granola I've ever had. That's great. It's very, very hard in the food business to dabble. I say you got to go all in. We get a ton of people. We have a lot of success stories on people that moonlighted until it grabbed them and grabbed them away from what they were doing to put bread on the table, which is admirable. I've seen a lot of that, but you got to be committed to what you're trying to do.
Now, are you seeing a trend in terms of a lot of these delivery places can find holes in the market? They can say, hey, in this little zip code, there's not a blah, 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 and there's a demand for it. I'm seeing there's a demand, and then I can kind of put my own thing in there.
Yeah, I think that's the space race right now going on in the delivery game. You have Travis Kalanick from Uber that invested $150 million, and he's probably leveraging it up to $1 billion. He's in that game. You have a company called Kitchens United. You have a company called Park Mobile, which is called Vessel. It's very interesting what's going to happen.
But doesn't that make it difficult for the small guy because they don't have access to that data?
No, that these guys not only provide a kitchen right in a hot zip code, but they're also providing the data. Mm-hmm. That's their offering.
So then they're encouraging the small guy to go into that space because they see there's a hole in the marketplace?
Yes, I believe so. I believe, you know, you wake up in 20 years and no matter what zip code you're in, within 3 minutes, you might be able to get whatever you want.
I'll be able to get pho anywhere I am in the city.
Yeah, like pass it through my window. I'm at this I'm at this intersection. I don't know.
We'll have to ask Seven about that.
No, it's a progression because, like, kind of a lot of cities go through the same patterns of growth. And imagine delivery services and kind of all these new models make things available for people that don't have it. And let's say in Atlanta, we're Clippers. We've had Uber Eats and DoorDash and Grubhub for years now. And Then we had a friend in Noonan that's like, we don't have any of those things. Right. Like, what is that? Like, we only have like Chili's and Applebee's
and
Burger King and stuff like that. And, you know, there's enough people kind of becoming foodies these days where everyone is taking pictures of their food. Everyone wants to share. And, you know, I think there's still lack of access to the kind of food that you want. And even in the city, and I live not that far from here, I'm like, if it's 2 a.m. and I want something,
there's
only so much I can do. There's still just Waffle House and McDonald's, but more people are kind of competing in this space, and it's good for everybody, I think.
All right. Well, thank you both for sharing your story. Seven, if people want to get a hold of you and find out whatever new thing you got going on.
Yeah. So as always, follow us on Instagram at Pokeberry. Follow us on Instagram at Lifting Noodles Ramen. If you want to get in touch with me directly, just don't do that. Leave me alone. I'm busy. No, I'm just kidding. But follow us on Instagram and, check out new things that we're doing, including Feast.
All right. And Mitch, the coordinates for Prep ATL and Feast?
Yeah. Feast is PHEAST.
Just like it sounds.
Yep. ATL.com and prep is prepatl.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you for sharing your story today.
Yeah, thank you.
And
for your time.
Follow us on Instagram at FeastATL. Yep.
All right. Well, thank you. And thanks to all our guests today. This is Lee Cantor for Sanjay Torre. We'll see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.